government established, and then it too pushed aside in the fall of 1917 by the radical revolutionaries, ultimately leading to a Bolshevik seizure of power. By the spring of 1918, the Bolsheviks had achieved what just a year before would have seemed utterly unbelievable. They had achieved power in Russia. They had removed Russia from the devastating conflict with Germany. And now came an enormous problem for the Bolsheviks. Could they sustain this revolution? Could they sustain the revolutionary momentum of these extraordinary events of 1917? Could they, in fact, translate revolution into a revolutionary regime that would bring about the kind of Marxist program that the Bolsheviks had envisioned? There were many threats to Bolshevik power in 1918. The Social Revolutionaries, by far the most popular of the revolutionary parties or factions, were opposed to Brest-Litovsk, felt that the Bolsheviks had given away too much, the war should have been continued. Indeed, in June of 1918, the Social Revolutionaries assassinated the German ambassador in an attempt to create conflict between Germany and Russia, put Russia back into the war, to reverse this humiliating Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And in August of 1918, the Social Revolutionaries would attempt to assassinate Lenin himself. Lenin was severely wounded, but the attempted coup misfired. Lenin would recover, and the threat from the Social Revolutionaries would be undermined by the work of the Cheka and the Red Terror, which the Bolsheviks would unleash in the aftermath of that assassination. At least 500 opponents, Social Revolutionaries and Mensheviks, were executed in one day in the aftermath of that failed coup. They were tried for, quote, crimes against the revolution. A new sense of revolutionary justice was now being established in Russia. The Tsar and his family, also in the summer of 1918, had been moved out of the capital to a town in the Urals, where in the summer of 1918, the imperial family was brutally executed, removing any possibility of the Tsar, however unlikely it might have been, of the Tsar leading a move to reestablish the old regime. By far the greatest threat to the new revolutionary regime came from what came to be called the White Russians. Opponents from the right of the new revolutionary regime. Generals from the Tsarist army, in particular, mobilized a military force against the Bolsheviks, determined to reverse the tide of revolution and to reestablish some form of monarchic government to restore the imperial family. Their strength was primarily to be found in Ukraine, in southern Russia, in Siberia, and in the Baltic. The national minorities revolted also against the new government. The Bolsheviks attempting to, their vague promises to the national minorities during the heady days of revolution now were called into question. In Ukraine and Georgia and Armenia, there were moves for national liberation, a breakdown of the old Tsarist empire. It didn't matter whether it was Tsarist or whether it was Bolshevik. Ukraine, Georgia, Armenia, and so on wanted national independence. And this was the opportunity. When the Bolsheviks had talked about minority rights for nationalities, they had not meant the right of secession or a break with the Russian state. In addition, there were threats from abroad. The White Russians, the White Revolutionaries, were able to count on support from the Allies, still very much in the throes of combat with the Germans. In the spring of 1918, following the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, the Allies were desperate to draw Russia back into the war. It was the time, as you'll recall, of the last major German offensive in the war, the one that was going to bring victory to Germany. The Allies were desperate to hold some form of Russian pressure on the Germans. And as a consequence, English troops were landed in Murmansk, and Japanese troops moved into Siberia. American troops landed at Archangel in the north, in this frozen, virtually Arctic port, attempting to hold the Russians into the war. I think when one considers what later seemed to be a kind of Bolshevik or communist paranoia in the Kremlin about counter-revolutionary forces in the West, the imperialist powers of the West were determined to undermine the revolution, the basis of that begins really with this Allied invasion, this attempt to bolster the white Russians in their war against the Bolsheviks, to overthrow the Bolsheviks and to bring back a Russian presence into the war. One of the miraculous achievements of the Bolsheviks in this period was the creation of the Red Army. Certainly the odds for a Bolshevik military force defeating the white Russians with their military commanders, with their support from the Allies, the odds were not very great. Some form of military force had to be created. The Bolshevik notion about the party being the vanguard of the proletariat, not a mass organization, but a small revolutionary cadre, did not suggest a broad-based party that would now recruit members for, or soldiers for, a new Red Army. And yet, in 1918 and into 1919, the Bolsheviks would indeed be able to create a military that was able to confront the white Russians in the field. This was achieved largely under the leadership of Leon Trotsky, who would be the leading figure in creating this Red Army, as it came to be called. In 1918 into 1919, Trotsky was peripatetic. He was everywhere, mobilizing units, organizing army forces, equipping them. Trotsky in this period lived in a railroad carriage, moving back and forth along this vast frontier behind Red Army lines, creating a military establishment to do battle. It was an extraordinary achievement. An absolutely extraordinary achievement, drawing on demobilized soldiers from the old Tsarist army, if not their military commanders, the rank-and-file troops, as well as others who were afraid that a victory of the white Russians would reverse the tide of revolution. By 1919, Trotsky had managed to create an armed force of over 3 million troops to do battle with the white Russians. During 1919, this new military force inflicted a series of defeats on the white Russians, and by 1920, the counter-revolutionaries were in full retreat. Indeed, by the summer of 1920, they had been routed, the threat to revolution from the white Russians largely broken. This period from 1918 to 1920, the period of civil war, as it came to be known, was an extraordinary period of chaos. If one thinks about this vast area of Western Russia, convulsed by revolution and now by war, of this ragtag group of Red Army troops being pulled together, made into a fighting force, fighting a bizarre coalition of Americans, French, English, and in the Far East, the Japanese, holding together, being able to prevail in the Civil War. In addition, after November 1918, after the armistice in which Germany had surrendered in the West, whole units of the German army never went back. They continued to stay on the Eastern Front, enlisted to fight alongside the white Russians, and fought in the Russian Civil War from 1918 down to 1920, and only in 1920 would come straggling back into Germany, complete with their weapons and so on. It was a period of disorder, of enormous violence, and of momentous events. And the man of the hour in all of this was Trotsky. It was during the Civil War that Trotsky's reputation would be built, that he would assume the stature of not an equal with Lenin. Lenin was clearly the man in charge of charting Bolshevik, the direction of Bolshevik policy. But Trotsky emerged along with Lenin at this juncture as probably the most visible of the Bolshevik leaders. And they had succeeded against enormous odds in prevailing in the Civil War. They had done so for a variety of reasons. One was that the peasants, though they were certainly sick of the enormous demands made upon them by the war effort, and had suffered because of privation during the war against the Germans, the peasants were afraid that if the White Russians were to emerge victorious in the Civil War, then the land distribution that the Bolsheviks had not only promised but had begun would be reversed, that there would be an attempt to restore aristocratic property, that the old regime would return, and this long-anticipated, long-desired agricultural reform, indeed agricultural revolution, would be undone. So, and the Bolsheviks played on this in mobilizing war-weary and hungry peasants to fight in the Red Army. Also, the Civil War was portrayed to the public as a national crusade against foreign invaders. That is, if the Bolsheviks couldn't mobilize support on the basis of Marxist ideology and on revolutionary principles, then they played the nationalist card. You're not fighting for the Tsar now, you're fighting for Russia, for Mother Russia, against foreign invaders. Not simply the White Russians, of course, but the presence of the Allies, the Americans, the Japanese, the French, the English, were presented as, you see, the forces, these counter-revolutionary forces are there, Mother Russia is invaded, it is time to pull together and to frustrate these foreign attempts to dominate Russia. Also important was the fact that the opponents, the enemies of the regime, were not united. Some, like the social revolutionaries, desired a revolutionary regime, much of the same in the way of land reform that the Bolsheviks were promising. But they did not want a revolutionary regime led by the Bolsheviks. I think for the social revolutionaries, who were, by every measurable indicator, the most popular party in Russia, there was a sense that they had been robbed of their revolutionary legacy, that this was their role. They should be leading the revolution. And so they wanted to establish a revolutionary regime. They were not interested in a restoration of the Tsar or even of a kind of liberal government, but they didn't. They saw the Bolsheviks as usurpers who had somehow managed to steal the legitimate victory of the social revolutionaries. Others, of course, wanted to see the return of the Tsar, wanted the old order returned. And then finally, there were the national minorities who hoped to see not simply a change of regime, but the independence of Ukraine, Georgia, and so on. So this tight leadership of the Bolsheviks, their fanatical leadership, internal lines of communication and command, which they also enjoyed because of the disposition of forces, gave the Red Army an enormous advantage in dealing with their opponents. But even after the Civil War had begun to flow in the direction of the Bolsheviks, after victory seemed assured, the new Bolshevik government, communist government, as it began to call itself, remained an outlaw state in Europe. It remained all in 1918, 1919, into 1920, very much a renegade. Excluded, as we've seen in our discussion of the negotiations at Versailles, excluded from participation in those deliberations. Part of the reason for this was that the Bolsheviks had begun putting the economic house of Russia together by renouncing the Russian national debt. This was a blow of enormous proportions to the Third Republic of France. France had invested greatly in Russia after 1890. Indeed, Russia enjoyed more French investment than French colonies did between 1890 and 1917. The Bolsheviks' decision to renege on the national debt meant that this French enormous capital investment in Russia was simply lost. Simply lost. The Bolshevik position was, we didn't borrow this money. It was not, it was the old regime that had done this. It was the Tsar's responsibility. It was the imperialist Tsarist regime responsible for the outbreak of the war. And the people of Russia are not going to pay the capitalist bloodsuckers of the West, et cetera, with the usual sort of revolutionary rhetoric. Nonetheless, the cancellation of this Russian national debt enraged many in Western Europe, particularly in France. In addition, the espousal of world revolution was seen as a made Russia appear as a serious destabilizing force in international affairs. In the midst of this titanic struggle in Russia to maintain the revolution, to defeat the White Russians, to defeat the interventionists, to defeat reactionaries and social revolutionaries, to maintain the Bolshevik regime, the Bolsheviks had also established the Third International, the so-called Comintern, in March of 1919. Not content with attempting to maintain their position in Russia, the creation of this Third International, or Comintern, in 1919 was a commitment to foment world revolution. The revolution Lenin believed and continued to believe into 1919 and beyond, the success of revolution in Russia depended on its spread into Central Europe. The Comintern was to be an organization that would overcome the mistakes of the First and Second Internationals. There would be no romantic pacifism, no romantic notion of revolution. This was to be a hard-headed revolutionary organization to link socialist parties, leftist parties around the world. What the founding of the Comintern also did was to establish a Russian claim to leadership in the international socialist movement. The Comintern was basically suggesting that Russia now, because of the success of the Bolshevik Revolution there, had the right, had a legitimate claim now for leadership in the international socialist movement. It would promote revolution and certainly called for leftist solidarity. This rubbed a great many socialists in Central and Western Europe the wrong way. The Bolsheviks, the communists now in Russia, had not been a particularly influential or important group in the international socialist movement before the outbreak of the First World War. Orthodox Marxists or revisionist Marxists in Central and Western Europe didn't necessarily accept the claim of leadership by the radical Bolsheviks. So there was a good deal of contention and ill will, even on the left, by the establishment of the Comintern. The Comintern's goal was to create an international revolutionary organization which would prepare, over the long run, for the inevitable working class revolution. Then in 1920, at its second Congress, the Comintern established 21 points, or conditions, to be met before a socialist party could gain entry into this august body. This set of conditions would provoke a schism within the socialist movement of profound importance. A division, a fissure, between the radical left, now known as communists, and the socialist parties of Central and Western Europe. This division, in which basically if one was going to adhere to the Comintern, one was going to have to recognize the primacy of Russia, of the Bolshevik and communist regime, and to subordinate the interests of the National Socialist parties to that of international socialism. This division, I might add, would make the battle of Central and Western European leftists against the fascist threat very, very difficult indeed. In fact, as the 1920s would turn into the early 1930s, the insistence on the Comintern of mobilizing support, of winning support among all socialist parties, would mean that the Comintern would develop a policy that, rather than seeing the fascist threat as the primary one, would argue that it was those socialist parties that refused to adhere, to toe the line, to adhere to the Comintern policy were the real problem, and that the socialist parties in Central and Western Europe who refused to recognize this domination of the Bolshevik tradition really represented nothing more than social fascism. We'll talk about this at a later date. For the immediate period, the establishment of the Comintern and its enthusiastic advocacy of world revolution seemed to announce to the rest of the world that one of the goals of the new Bolshevik regime was to undermine authority everywhere. So in addition to its status as an outlaw state, the new regime also quickly demonstrated the characteristics of an oppressive authoritarian regime as well. The regime fulfilled its promises concerning land, but continued in many ways the authoritarian political control exercised by the old czarist regime. The All-Russian Extraordinary Commission, the Cheka, as we've seen, established in 1917 to combat what was referred to as counter-revolution and sabotage, would continue under the Bolsheviks during and after the Civil War, operating now as a secret police to thwart counter-revolutionary activities everywhere. Indeed, the Cheka had been used to smash the social revolutionaries in 1918 and other political opponents during the Civil War and beyond. In addition, the new regime established by Lenin and his comrades wanted to exercise centralized control over the vast empire that it now commanded. Centralized control from Moscow was to be the key organizing principle of this regime. Power was in the hands of the Communist Party, not a coalition of socialist or leftist parties, not in the hands of the Soviets, but rather in the leadership of the Communist Party. Moscow was also determined to quell separatist sentiments everywhere and hence monitored the different nationalities and ethnic groups closely, especially in Ukraine and in the Caucasus. Alert always for the threat of secession, of nationalist rejection of Moscow's leadership. When the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, was created officially in December 1922, it was only nominally a federation, only nominally a federal state, but rather a highly centralized state controlled from Moscow, controlled by the Communist Party. The regimes also took the first steps toward creating a socialist economy. War communism, as the policy was called during the Civil War, represented a strategy to seize what the Bolsheviks referred to as the commanding heights, heavy industry, the banks, the means of communication, transportation, and, of course, the large agrarian estates. This policy of forced nationalization proved very difficult indeed during the Civil War. There were great problems involved in this policy of war communism. Initially, industrial production dropped, indeed dropped catastrophically. It was by the end of the Civil War, Russia was producing at only one-fifth of its 1913 levels. Strikes in factories were not uncommon, and even the sailors mutinied in the Kronstadt naval base in 1920. Land reform also met with serious problems. The first decrees of the Bolshevik regime ordering the seizure of states had led to inequitable distribution. When the regime then sought to collectivize farms, their efforts met with enormous opposition and ended in failure. This, the initial seizure of estates, meant distribution to local peasantry. At a certain point, after this initial distribution, the land was supposed to move to the state, and the state would then move to collectivize agriculture. When the Bolshevik regime got around to doing that, after the Civil War, it met with terrific resistance, and agricultural production declined and declined steadily until 1921 as a result of the chaos and resistance. Finally, in March of 1921, faced with a deteriorating economic situation, Lenin took the extraordinary step of adopting what was called the New Economic Policy, NEP. NEP. It represented in many ways a step backward by the regime in an attempt to revive production. In some cases, old Tsarist officials were returned to administer the policy. Transportation, the banking industry, wholesale commerce, and the major industrial industries remained under government control, as was foreign trade, but agriculture remained largely in private hands, dominated by a class now of richer peasants called kulaks. The NEP, the NEP, was a dramatic success. The retail sector rebounded, and by 1927, the economy finally had returned to production levels of 1913. But at what cost to socialist policy? Could the new economic policy be sustained indefinitely, especially since it appeared that the revolution could not be exported for the foreseeable future? That is, by 1921-22, the hopes of spreading revolution to Central Europe had largely been abandoned. Did this represent a deserting of Marxist ideology? A battle began to shape up over the future, the course of Russian economic, social, and political policy. A battle over that focused on NEP, on the NEP, and on the nature of industrialization in Russia. In 1922, Lenin would suffer the first of a series of strokes that would finally end his life in January of 1924. His deteriorating condition set off a power struggle within the communist leadership over both the question of succession, who would follow Lenin, and over policy. And the lines were clearly drawn before Lenin's death. On the one hand, Trotsky, the hero of the Civil War, favored even tighter government controls over agriculture and industry to speed up industrialization. And he continued to insist on the policy of world revolution, that the Bolsheviks shouldn't back away from this commitment to world revolution. Nikolai Bukharin differed, wanted to pursue a policy of loose controls and gradual growth, in effect, a continuation of the NEP. Lenin, in the last months of his life, seemed to be leaning toward Bukharin, this notion of continuing NEP and moving on a more gradual pace toward the nationalization of the economy. But it was neither Bukharin nor Trotsky who would follow Lenin and would place his indelible stamp on Russia and the Soviet Union, but the secretary of the Communist Party, a man by the name of Joseph Stalin. Shortly before his death, Lenin appeared to be increasingly concerned over the course of the future policy in the Soviet Union, concerned that Stalin, a bland and in many ways colorless bureaucrat, or so he appeared to many, might be in a position to determine the outcome of those policy decisions. That is the story that we will take up in our next lecture.